The human body has an amazing capacity to heal itself, one that the world of medicine is only beginning to exploit. Regenerative medicine is aimed at harnessing powers within us that can succeed where medications have failed. And the upcoming Pacific Regenerative Medicine Conference will bring together clinicians from around the world to look at recent advances in the field. Brian Avery is the conference chair. He's with us in our studio.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
What's your educational background in this whole field?
Well, I started my BSc. I came from Canada, so it was at the University of Guelph, and that was in biomedical science. Mm-hmm. And then I completed my master's of science, and that was in human biology and nutrition. Mm-hmm. And then I went on for PhD training, and that was more focused on anatomy and cell biology. So over those three, I was able to really build on the biomedicine of the human body.
The whole idea is understanding how the things that go on the body can have a healing effect.
Yeah. And, you know, that's changed so much over the years. Even in the last 5 years, we've gone leaps and bounds to where we were in the past. And that's thanks to a lot of people in regenerative medicine that have taken upon it it's a discipline called translational medicine. So they're able to take the information that researchers have developed in the bench, in the laboratory, mm-hmm. and apply that to the bedside or to the community at large. Mm-hmm. And that, even when I was starting off at university, wasn't happening very much. A lot of the benchtop research was specifically just to gain more knowledge in that specific area. And then the next person coming along would add to that. And we would accumulate all this knowledge. So how did it get from the bench to the bedside? And that was left up to clinicians. Now they're also a part of the regenerative medicine field, these clinicians.
What's an example of something that regenerative medicine can do?
Well, it is very large field. Regenerative medicine is somewhat of an umbrella that looks at bioengineering, genetic therapy, immunotherapy. So in immunotherapy, we can use regenerative medicine to help treat even something as complicated as cancers by boosting the immune system, so getting your body to heal itself. So a disease usually results because of some sort of insult on our ability to regenerate or to heal ourselves. Mm-hmm. So if we could step in somehow and either reinstruct the immune system or give it tools that it needs to be fully functional, then we can treat diseases. So with cancer, one specific example would be able to take T cells, which are a specific cell in the immune system that attacks foreign material that has invaded our body. We can take those T cells out, reprogram them to specifically search out cancer, specific types of cancer, not all cancers, and just attack that alone and rid the body of that invading cancer. So those things are happening now today in Canada, U.S., and around the world.
This encompasses so-called stem cell research?
Yes, stem cell research is one branch of regenerative medicine. And that's usually what comes to mind when people hear regenerative mm-hmm. medicine. But it's not everything. Tissue engineering is part of it as well, and also the bioengineering, so making materials. So coming up with biologically inert material that can be transplanted into the body to replace damaged tissue and get you back to health.
You were telling me an example of someone who, I think it was in Spain, who had a trachea replaced.
Yeah, that was so cool. I know that's really what started me down the path. That was some years ago. Now, trachea is mostly cartilage. Mm-hmm. So really, it's not very complicated at the tissue level. So they were able to engineer a bioscaffolding that was biologically inert. But imagine it at the microscopic level, that's very porous.
Like a tube that you actually insert inside your throat to replace the organic tube that's there.
That's right. So they were able to transplant these cells onto this the material that were the patient's own cells, and transplant that into the defective area in the trachea, in the throat. And over time, those cells grew into the trachea.
Mm-hmm.
And after 3-4 years, that material does dissolve away, and what's left behind is a natural trachea that's your own, so there's no worry of rejection, and you have complete recovery. And so those things are happening. We can do that with tendons in the body, bone, and other ligaments as well.
If I wanted to get a treatment of that kind done, could I get it done in the United States?
Yes, you can. There's many centers. There's about a half a dozen research companies that are coming out with new technologies every day. There's regenerative medicine clinics all over the country, from California to New York, Canada as well, and other countries around the world. Now, it's young, regenerative medicine, in the sense that the term was only coined in 1992, but regenerative medicine has been around for a long time. When you think of the first organ transplant surgery that was ever done, that's regenerative medicine. So to search out these clinics, it's not a difficult task at all, just typing in regenerative medicine in the internet today, and you'll find hundreds of clinics.
You did say California to New York, meaning that Hawaii is notably excluded.
There's a few people, there are, and there's some, but we have... We need to, you know, plug into that potential, that you know, capability to service our own population. But then also, this also opens up the door to a branch of medicine called medical tourism, where we can bring people to Hawaii for medical treatment, which will then also increase our ability to treat our own population at a higher level.
Where is what's the Center of Medical Tourism today?
Well, Center of Medical Tourism today here in Hawaii is very, very small. We haven't gotten together as a cohesive group from the tourist industry right down to hotel physicians and all the doctors and surgeons in town to come together to decide how we should, you know, get medical tourism growing in Hawaii. So really, it's non-existent.
Where have they done it?
Oh, you know, let's see. The biggest country right now with medical tourism is India, but Korea, Thailand. But even states in the U.S., there are starting to be centers for medical tourism, bringing people from out from other countries to the U.S. California is really capitalizing on $1 billion a year industry for them, bringing in people from other countries to treat them with stem cell therapies.
Well, Hawaii could use a few billion-dollar industries, couldn't it?
Yeah, because it's a big industry. Medical tourism is around just above $100 billion a year industry, and it grows by approximately 25% every year, and we haven't capitalized on that yet.
Well, more to be learned about that. Thanks very much, Brian.
Yes.
Brian Avery is the Pacific Regenerative Medicine Conference Chair, as well as the President and Founder of Hawaii Bioskills. The Pacific Regenerative Medicine Conference will be held on November 6th and 7th at the Hawaii Convention Center. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, dealing with cancer by harnessing the power of the mind. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a man who served in naval intelligence during the Second World War and made Hawaii his home from then on. He was a lifelong Republican whose political career is thought of as the end of a period of Republican domination of territorial politics that extended all the way back to the 1893 overthrow of the monarchy. He was an attorney educated at Harvard Law School whose involvement in local politics began when he acted as broker in a complex Hawaii Island land dispute. He won election to the Territorial Senate in 1956 and began working with his Democratic rival, then congressional delegate John A. Burns, on the Hawaii Statehood Commission. President Eisenhower appointed him as territorial governor in 1957, and he won election as governor of the newly minted state in 1959. He was the last Republican to hold that office until Linda Lingle won it in 2002, and today we're looking for his name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
When your world seems to be falling apart, it's hard to take a step back and just breathe. But that's what local DJ Christina Whitmire decided to do when she was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. She began Zen training and believes it has helped her to feel calmer and less attached to her illness. Now she wants to share what she has learned. Michael Hodge was Krista's teacher throughout her training, and Noe Tanigawa spoke with both of them and asked what it meant to have the focus of one's world changed.
2 years ago, I got diagnosed with breast cancer at stage 4 when I was 39. So everything that I was doing, I had to kind of just come to a screeching halt. And, you know, now I'm only worried about staying alive. And so the one thing that happened was that after 12 weeks, I was showing no signs of disease in my scans. And 6 months later, it was the same result. So it wasn't a mistake. And you know, that's huge. And for me, through that, I just discovered so many things, you know, that I needed to know. That's why I still look at it like a blessing. You know, that was right around the time that I met Michael, and he kind of introduced me to this place, this dojo. And, you know, sitting without being able to do anything except sit there and breathe, and you have to breathe in a very specific way. It's, you know, I haven't even been doing it very long, maybe 4 months, 3 months. I can already feel things that I never really felt before. And mainly it's just like I don't feel like I have to be in control of everything because I was kind of a control freak.
But Zen pursuits have not traditionally been taken lightly.
Yeah, it's a funny equation. How it works is that, you know, that impression is correct, that there's a lot of discipline and a lot of form, and it can feel like there's a lot of rules and a lot of rigid kind of things to follow. But what's funny about the equation is all of that stuff added together ends up with sort of total relaxation and freedom and openness. And it's kind of, it's not maybe a rational progression how rigid form and rules lead to that. But it has something to do with, if you can get rid of yourself, if you can get rid of how do I want to do things and what's my approach, is you start to be able to use your senses more completely and experience the world more completely, you then end up not stuck on all those forms. So they're there. There's a certain power that comes with that discipline.
I was trying by myself first, and I was getting nowhere. I was like sitting in my living room with the stopwatch, and I would sit there and I would just try to stay real still and quiet my mind. And I'd look at the clock after thinking it's an hour, and it was like 4 minutes. So, so he had me come up here. And once I started coming up here, I don't know, you don't want to move. You sit there, and whether or not my form is right or my breath or my posture, I have to come. And now, I mean, I come every single day, every in the morning, and I can't stop. I mean, there's some days I need to take off. My body's just really sore from this hormone therapy. It makes, you know, the bones are really, sometimes I can't get out of bed. But for the most part, you know, I've been here since June.
And so, you know, again, the challenge is to give people a taste of that, or to let folks see that that's possible, that it's possible to, you know, go through something really tough, or go through something really that normally would be really gut-wrenching, and do it in a way where you could feel like that's a blessing, or that that has allowed you to open up or be more free or be more empathetic.
You know, the rigorous reputation of Zen training, does that happen here?
We had a group sitting in Shanghai for a while, and so we get people from all over the world who had been trained in different traditions, and I've never had somebody say that what they did somewhere else was more intense than what we do, or more brutal, or, you know, this has always been the standard in terms of how deep can you train.
Whacked over the head with bamboo sticks and such.
Well, I mean, yeah, we do kendo up here, but not so much intensity from just, like, physical violence, but just how sincere the effort is, that we'll sit a long time, or we don't indulge in, you know, something feels a little uncomfortable, so we stop. You know, we just kind of go through it. And at a very basic level, it just builds strength. It builds a certain kind of both physical and spiritual strength in people. But on a deeper level, what it does is it provides a venue to go touch those deep places of the human psyche, physical experience, that can be uncomfortable or can be scary. And you kind of need a laboratory to do it. You kind of need a place that provides a controlled environment. You don't want to go do that, you know, in the middle of another situation where people aren't ready to handle that kind of stuff coming out. And so Chosenji, I think, is really unique in that sense, is that we take all kinds of people and we see all kinds of reactions to that up here, and that doesn't scare us off to have people going deep.
That's all going on while people are actually appear to just be sitting there, you're saying?
At varying levels. So we have plenty of introductory things that might not sound as intense as what I just described. But when we do, like, the intensive twice a year, we'll do a week-long session or intensive training. You see the whole spectrum of human emotion and endeavor. And it's really beautiful. I don't think we have many places in the world that where that's happening actively at that level.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
But I think to come out here in the back of Kalihi Valley and really try to understand this Zen approach is good. I mean, especially when I was really sick, and it was well, how are you looking at this illness? You know, are you fully attached to it? Is it just like, is that who you are, or can you figure out another way? And I just hope that they can all find that way that I have, and we can all just take it on, you know. Don't run from it.
In a funny way, these are all folks who have an advantage, because they're confronting all the heavy stuff of who am I, why am I here, where am I going, and it's happening fast. And rather than running away from it, or rather than saying, hey, shoot, that's not what I planned. That's not how my life was supposed to go. You know, I had all this other stuff lined up, and what we're planning on is that people will get a chance to sit down and do some meditation. It's not going to be easy. It's not fun stuff, you know, but you'll start to see, you know, people can see their breath as a tool to, rather than like, oh, my knee is hurting, my knee is hurting, my knee is hurting. It's like, okay, my knee's hurting, but there's, the birds are chirping out there too. And we tend to just focus on some internal discomfort and block out everything else. And it actually can flip around where you end up experiencing the birds so much more fully. Whether you're going through treatment yourself, or you're a caregiver, or somebody you love is going through it, is that it feels like you got a raw deal. It feels like you drew the short straw. There's a totally other way to look at it. It's like you actually got the golden ticket, which is that now you got an opportunity way faster to experience what it really means to be human.
Christina Whitmire is a cancer survivor who used Zen training to endure her struggle with that disease. Her seminar, A Zen Approach, will be put on by the Aloha Cancer Project on October 28th at Daihonzan Chosenji in Honolulu, where Michael Hodge is a priest.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
No one can say where the Kealoha investigation will end, but one thing is apparent. The indictment and arrest of the former police chief and his city prosecutor were only the beginning of a new phase. Five HPD officers have been arrested, and one has already pled guilty. A new federal grand jury has been impaneled, and a special prosecutor is returning to Hawaii to continue an investigation that could grow to include the Honolulu Prosecutor's Office. Reporter Nick Gruby has more in today's Reality Check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
This, Watergate started with a third-rate burglary, and this started with the theft of a mailbox, but these things have a way of growing and growing, especially when they go federal, don't they?
Yeah, well, really, this mailbox was the keyhole into this entire alleged conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office to sort of start looking into whether or not there was more corruption within the Honolulu Police Department, and it sort of allowed them to flip over a bunch of rocks and pursue what they found underneath those rocks. And while it started with an alleged frame job for the mailbox theft, it's now turned into a much larger conspiracy in which the former head of the Honolulu Police Department and some of his elite officers are accused of destroying evidence, falsifying police reports, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, it is now also raising questions about what's going on in the city Honolulu Prosecuting Attorney's Office, since that's where former Police Chief Louis Kealoha's wife, Catherine, used to work.
Well,
or still works there. Sorry, excuse me.
The complaint document looks at a whole what almost seems like a culture of corruption involving a great many people and extending well beyond this one alleged frame job. Yeah,
right. I mean, what the indictment shows are a lot of allegations, including those related to bank fraud as well as stealing money from minors who allegations of stealing money from minors who Catherine Kealoha had guardianship over, and that it shows that the Kealohas used this money, whether it's from the minors or from other family members who she's alleged to have taken money from, to sort of promote their own lavish lifestyle, including payments for a Maserati and Mercedes Benz and a $26,000 party for Louis Kealoha in 2009 after he was named as the police chief of one of the largest police departments in the country.
All this all of this was highly visible, and you would think that there would perhaps have been some red flags when your police chief's driving a Maserati. That's a little bit beyond a lot of police chief salaries.
Yeah, what I think is interesting about this entire case is the sheer lack of oversight that was in place. I mean, you have a Honolulu Police Commission whose job it is to monitor the police chief and his actions, yet throughout his career, Louis Kealoha was considered a great employee, and he always had high marks. You also had the Honolulu Prosecuting Attorney's Office not really doing its job to monitor whether or not Catherine Kealoha was on the up and up. So there were a lot of people who were paying attention that just didn't notice what was happening
The feds are paying attention now, and they don't have any local allegiances, so that'll color their investigation. Thanks very much, Nick, for talking with us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Nick Gruby. Few of us are entirely safe from cybercrime, and our vulnerability is only enhanced by how little we understand it. It's all too easy to surrender your personal information for a seemingly innocent purpose, and it's all too easy for the cyber criminal to take advantage. Is Reynold Hiroki's Kuleana as cybersecurity coordinator for the State Department of Defense to inform people about its dangers, and we spoke the other day.
I think it actually is the most vulnerable area because a lot of it is you can't see it. And unlike the physical side, where if someone tries to do something to you, it's one person doing something to you, and it takes time. On the cyber side, it could be one person doing things to a million people in a fraction of a second. So it's complicated. And it's very difficult.
And undetectable for most of us, entirely undetectable.
Until a couple months later, maybe, when you get your credit card bill or those type of things. So it is a complicated thing. But, you know, what we do on the State Department of Defense, where I come from, is really, short of that, there is things you can do. So we call it cyber safety awareness. Another term is cyber hygiene.
I never heard that one before.
So it's just like personal hygiene, right? You wash your hands, you brush your teeth. You may not be convinced this is helping you, but we all do it.
Yeah.
Right? So in cyber security, cyber safety, cyber hygiene is the different things that you do. And if you, believe it or not, if you do these things, there's a good chance, a much better chance that you won't be affected. So a couple examples is, and you know this, updating your having antivirus is good, but of course you have to update it and you have to run it.
Yeah.
Make sure it's configured. So if it's not doing anything, then it's worth nothing. It's like putting toothpaste on your toothbrush, but not brushing. So there's a bunch of different things that we recommend.
So that being one of them, what are some of the others?
So another one would be patching all of your software. So we are not at the day where the software companies build bulletproof software. Every piece of software has a weakness or a vulnerability that the malicious cyber criminal can take advantage of and either get your data, worst case, take control of your computer. So again, you don't see things happen when you update your operating system, your antivirus, your internet browser, but it is actually protecting you. And if you're unfortunate and you click on something, you open something, you read something, and you're not protected, that piece of malware that you just clicked on can affect your computer and, again, take data and possibly take control of your computer.
So all you need to do is click on the wrong site, and you've opened the door into your data.
Yeah. In fact, there's two things that you should always really stop, think, and then click on, and that is attachments as well as links, either attachments on the website or links on a website, or more scary is things that come into your email system.
Yeah, I've heard about that. You clickbait, so-called, right? Yes. Something that is perhaps a tempting offer. Click here, and you will get, 50% off on your airline ticket, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and some of it is common sense. I mean, there are deals out there, don't get me wrong. But, if it's free, it probably is not free.
Yeah.
It's probably a better deal than you could ever think. Because the person on the other side, I mean, it is as simple as clicking on something, and now your computer is taken over. I mean, there's other things that need to be involved, but basically they want you to click. So they're not going to, send you something boring that you will ignore. It's going to be something tempting, something that you need to do it now, and there is enough reward or benefit that you might take that risk.
Well, the trouble is that's asking you to go into the same kind of behavior that you would to buy a book on Amazon or make a perfectly legitimate purchase online, right?
Yeah. So just like the real world, I don't know about you, but there are some areas I would not go to in town.
Sure.
There are some stores I would not go into because the risk is too great, right? But at the same time, there's stores that we frequent all the time. There's good reputation to the store. in the past, they've done well for us, giving us what we want. And so there's a good experience there. So it's the same thing with the internet. If there is an organization that's huge, a big organization that has their reputation online, of course, and you've read about them, you know about them, everyone goes there, there's probably a good chance that it's safe. But if you do a Google search on something and you're trying to find your favorite, I don't know, CD somehow, and it comes up that this site is selling it for 50 cents.
And you should smell a rat.
You never saw that site before. No one has ever told you about that site.
Yeah,
Don't get me wrong. There's things that the Google world does to kind of keep that from happening, but things slip through. So you might not want to go there, right? So you're downtown. You've never gone to that store. You don't know.
Yeah.
And that's how. So a lot of it really is, when I explain it to people, it's really, would someone ever do that? Would they ever create a really nice-looking website and try to take my stuff? And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Would a person actually impersonate a person to get into my work area to steal my password or my – or yes. And a lot of that is happening. And that is what – the technical term is social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens all the time. There are people that actually specialize that in the criminal world.
You talked about getting you might get an email and be tempted to click on something. And I've gotten emails that purported to be from a well-known, legitimate, large company, an Amazon or a United Airlines, but in fact were using that name as part of the email message, but they weren't really mm-hmm. Amazon or United Airlines. So that seems to be a pretty common way to tempt you into clicking on something.
So it's pretty easy to spoof. The email address looks like it's Amazon. So it's easy to spoof. But at the same time, all those links, the email address, when you have a link in the email, you can put your mouse over it and hover to just move the mouse over. And somewhere in the bottom, it'll tell you what the actual address is.
Mm-hmm.
So it might say Amazon.com. You know, click here, Amazon.com/ and a bunch of things. And it looks very varied. But when you put your mouse over and you look at the bottom, it's going to be something. It might look like Amazon.com, but it might be Amazon.com. I'm sorry, Amazon-something-something.com.
Exactly, a slight
it's
difference.
It's not Amazon.com. It's everything else. And an organization like Amazon puts their pride in place to put it as Amazon.com. So if you see something different, it's fishy. I mean, you might not want to go there. And that's really key when you hover your mouse over the link. If it's not what it is. Now, don't get me wrong. It might say click here for something, something, something. And if you look, it's Amazon.com. That's fine. Because the point is, what you see on your email has nothing to do with what that link is. It's two different things. One is a description, and one is actually the link. So you could say, click here. You could say, my favorite store is. It just doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty sneaky, isn't it? And you know, I get the impression with cybercrime in general that it's pretty easy for them, the bad guys, to stay a step ahead. I mean, that seems to have been its history.
It's definitely. So people say, well, I went to a site and it looked just like Amazon.com. Can someone actually create a website just like Amazon? Does it make sense? And the answer is there are tools out there. If you know what you're doing, you can make a website look just like Amazon.com, because all you're doing is making a cut and paste of Amazon.com, and now you have your own website.
Reynold Hiroki is the cybersecurity coordinator for the Hawaii State Department of Defense.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet, plus what we can look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, we're tapping into the expertise of Christopher Phillips, who is on the line now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. For this week, stargazers, look out for Venus in the morning sky when it rises in the east at 5 a.m. Also, look out for Saturn in the westerly evening sky after sunset. This week, the moon will be passing through its first quarter phase, meaning, of course, that our skies will get brighter towards week 10.
This week, we're digging into new information about an exploration that's not too far from Earth compared to the stuff we were talking about last week.
Yeah, after all the news stories of gravitational waves and exoplanets and far out happenings in the universe, it's easy to forget about some of the incredible explorations that are going on right here in the solar system, specifically that of the Mars Curiosity mission. It's been over 5 years since Curiosity landed on Mars, and ever since then, it has been constantly on the move, exploring the incredible Martian landscape.
They've been sending back some really cool images recently.
It has. Curiosity has been beaming back some of its cosmic postcards, and what's really quite awesome is just how much some of these images remind me of the Earth. Some of these images even show Martian weather. Weather on Mars. Isn't that fantastic?
So snow, rain, there are people shoveling, the plows. What exactly are you seeing there?
Okay, so it's not quite Earth-like weather, but we are seeing clouds and dust and even something that looks like mist or fog.
These rovers, how is it powered and how long can it continue to work?
Well, Curiosity has a plutonium power source. It's nuclear-powered, so in theory, it could run until that runs out, maybe, I don't know, 100 or so years. But in reality, it's more likely that mechanical failure will end the mission.
Right.
Like something breaking, like the wheels or the drills or something like that.
I get it. Makes total sense. And what's the next step for this mission that could go on for way past our lifetimes, considering they don't if they don't break a wheel on it?
Well, it may be possible that ancient microbial life on Mars has left behind signs for us to find. And scientists suspect that Martian rocks rich in metals may show some of those signs. So that's what Curiosity will be going after next.
And Christopher has sent along some images to go with this report. You can see them at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you.
Welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, featuring ZipPass, a new online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
For today's backyard quiz, we thought about a man who was the last in a long line of Republican leaders of the territory of Hawaii. His many accomplishments include an appearance as a guest panelist on the television game show What's My Line, service as Grand Marshal in the Tournament of Roses Parade, and performances with the Honolulu Light Opera. He's best remembered, though, as the first governor after statehood and the last governor of the territory of Hawaii. He was appointed territorial governor by a Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, and won election as a Republican to the state's top office after statehood in 1959, defeating congressional delegate John A. Burns. When he ran for re-election against Burns in 1962, his lieutenant governor, James K. Aloha, split the vote, and Burns was elected. He died in 2006, and his name was William Francis Quinn. Bill Pimental was of Kailua, was the first of several callers who knew and remembered Governor Quinn. And congratulations to all, and you will get the prize at today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Frank Abagnale Jr. is a legendary former con man whose teenage exploits were the subject of Steven Spielberg's 2002 film, Catch Me If You Can. Frank was eventually caught by the FBI after impersonating a doctor, an airline pilot, a lawyer, and numerous other professions. During his misbegotten youth, Frank pioneered the field of check fraud. After serving time, Frank became a consultant for the FBI and now helps private companies and organizations avoid being the victims of fraud and identity theft. During a recent visit to Hawaii, Frank told our producer Ryan Finnerty that the human element is still the most essential element to a good con, but modern technology makes fraud easier to perpetrate.
crime has become 4,000 times easier than when I did it 50 years ago as a teenager, and that's mainly because of technology. Technology breeds crime. It always has. It always will. So, you know, everything from printing checks. When I printed checks, you needed a Heidelberg printing press. That was a $1 million press. It took 12 months to learn how to operate it. There were color separations, negatives, plates, and typesetting. Today, you open a laptop and you create a check in less than 5 or 10 minutes, and you're able to go down the office supply store and buy secure check paper, and then you're able to print it out on an inkjet printer. So technology has made crime a lot easier, and crime has certainly become a lot more global. So today people are committing crimes from thousands of miles away in China and Malaysia and India and Hong Kong, and to victims that are sitting thousands of miles away from them. So all around the crime and the delivery of the message of scams and things of that have become a lot easier than they were when I did it some 50 years ago.
In the film, Catch Me If You Can, you're depicted as using pretty rudimentary techniques and kind of pioneering the field of check fraud. I imagine today much more sophisticated techniques are used.
Yeah, because of the ability today with graphic technology and things of that nature, color copiers, the ability of scanners. The one thing that hasn't changed and never will change, there is no technology today, and there never will be any technology that can stop social engineering. So the only way you prevent social engineering is through education. So back when I was 16 years old, I used social engineering with a telephone to find out where I could get a Pan Am uniform from. Today they use social engineering to find out so many other things, and they have so other means of using it through technology with computers and emails and texts and et cetera. So you're only going to prevent social engineering by educating people how to recognize it and how to act when they know they're being social engineered by someone.
What kinds of common social engineering schemes do you commonly see today?
Well, for example, I had a call a couple of weeks ago from a CFO of a technology company in California. They have 4,000 employees. They claim that their accounting department received an email from their CEO, their chief executive officer, saying that he wanted all the files, the W-2 files, on all of their employees so he could review them. So they sent the files up, and a couple of days later, the accounting department followed up and said, "Hope you got everything you needed. Let us know if you need anything else." And he wrote back and said, "I didn't ask for any of this." Had the person in the accounting department been taught about social engineering, they would have known that that was a very unusual request. So they would have got up from their desk, walked over, pressed the button, went up on the elevator to the CEO's office, knocked on the door and say, "Did you request this information from me?" Instead, now they have 4,000 of their employees' personal information out into the marketplace.
So no matter what new technology comes into the marketplace and into our lives, you're saying that identity theft is at its core a human-to-human interaction.
Absolutely, and that's the same with every breach. I've worked all the breaches back 15 years ago to TJ Maxx. Every breach that occurs, including Equifax, every breach that occurs because somebody in that company did something they weren't supposed to do, or somebody in that company failed to do something they were supposed to do. Hackers do not cause breaches. People do. So in the case of Equifax, they failed to update their infrastructure and their security and their patches that needed to be updated. So they allowed the hacker to access that information, and now 143 million people's information is out there for someone to misuse. So every hack, every breach occurs because someone did something they weren't supposed to do, or they failed to do what they were supposed to do.
Do you think the prominence of these digital technologies and much of our identities being stored on digital means in the cloud today, does that make us more secure or less secure and more vulnerable to identity theft?
Less secure, I think, in many cases, because we don't know all the people who are storing our information. So, you know, if we get someone who says, "Hey, I can for a fee store all your passwords so you don't have to remember them all," who is that? Is that a company with four employees working out of a loft somewhere, or is that a company with 4,000 employees and sophisticated technology and security and infrastructure in place. A lot of people are keeping our data that really have no security over that data. They don't update their infrastructure. They're not doing a very good job of protecting that that information. So that's the problem. Our information, including the government, I mean, we had a breach with the Office of Personnel Management. 21 million federal government employees had their information stolen. So, you know, technology is only good if you use it. If you're not using it and you're not following the right protocol to protect that information, then it's going to get in the hands of someone else.
So is the solution to this problem, Frank, a tool? Or is there a specific security measure that needs to be in place, or is it training of people in these positions, or some blend of both?
It's all about education. So this is Cyber Awareness Month. So I just came from Google. I was there on Monday and spoke to their security and privacy team about those issues. During this month, I usually go out to Fortune 500 companies and speak to their employees. But for years when I did this, I would go out to the company and I would not park in the visitor parking lot. I parked in the employee parking lot. And when I got out of my car, I emptied my pockets of memory sticks that I threw on the ground, and all of them said confidential. Then at lunchtime in their cafeteria, I would open them to see how many employees went to see what that memory stick had on it. And of course, I had a tracing device on them and a tracking device, so they would open it and it would say, this is a test and you failed. But later I explained to them that I could have cost their company $1 billion overnight and could have ruined their 100-year-old brand. So it really is about bringing that education message to their employees on a constant basis. Whether you're the CEO or you're the janitor of the company, the number one job you have is to keep the information that's been entrusted with you safe.
All the digital security in the world isn't going to prevent an employee from putting a flash drive where they shouldn't, right?
Exactly. So, you know, no matter how many TSA officers there are at the airport, the fact is I only need to get to one of them to get through. So what is the character of the TSA officer? What is the ethics of the TSA officer? Because it only takes that weak link to make it work, and that's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
Frank, you were brought out to Hawaii by AARP, which represents elderly members of the community. Are there certain demographics or groups of people that are more commonly targeted for identity theft than others?
Not necessarily. You know, AARP has 40 million members, and about a year ago they did a survey with Microsoft of 10,000 people, and they found that actually millennials fall for more computer scams over the telephone and over the internet than actually elderly people do. Anyone can fall for a scam. The truth is, and thank God, the majority of people are honest. And because they're honest, they don't think in a deceptive way. So when someone calls and says they're from the IRS, or their caller ID says it is the IRS or the police department, they don't know that you can manipulate the caller ID. So when they pick up the phone and someone has a lot of information about them, they truly believe that is their bank. Only their bank would know all that about them. They don't realize that on Facebook they told everyone all those things, their wife's maiden name, their children's names, where they go to school, what kind of car they drive. All of that information is available through social media, and criminals gather that information just to convince you over the phone or over the email they are who they say they are. So today you have to be a little smarter, you have to be a little wiser, and as I tell people all the time, you just need to stop and verify. The red flags are very simple. The minute I start asking you for money, or I start asking you for information like your Social Security number, date of birth, that's the red flag. You need to then stop and make sure you know who you're talking to. You hang up the phone, you pick up the phone book, you look up the Internal Revenue's number, the police department's number, your bank's number, and you call them directly and verify that information. If you just live by those two words about stop, verify, it'll save you a lot of money. There's nothing wrong with being skeptical. It's a virtue, actually, and you need to make sure you know who you're dealing with when someone wants you to part with your money.
So cultivating those instincts in the general population is going to be key to preventing this trend of identity theft.
Absolutely. You know, I've been doing this for over 40 years. Education is the most powerful tool to fighting crime. If you can educate people and explain how these scams work, then the next time they get that call, they get that letter, they get that email, they'll know exactly how to act.
and we have to go in just a minute, Frank, but where can people go to get reliable sources for that education, for training to help better prepare them for these types of attacks?
This is my third year working with AARP. About 3 years ago, they surveyed their 40 million members and asked them what their number one concern was, and they were amazed that they came back and said fraud, overwhelmingly. And so they went out to find resources and couldn't find any in government or outside of government. So they hired me to come along and help them develop what is now today the Fraud Watch Network, which allows for people, whether they're AARP members or not members, 18 years old or 88 years old, to go to the Fraud Watch Network at AARP, and they can watch videos of these scams, learn how these scams are perpetrated. I've been to 30 states on their behalf over the last 3 years, helping educate people and developing videos with them and educational material. So they've taken it upon themselves to do that. And what I like most of all, they sell nothing. There's no fee to attend. Doesn't matter whether you're a member or a non-member. They're just out there to help educate people with some obviously big concern people have about their protecting their personal fraud for being fraud and identity theft.
All right. Frank Abagnale, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for giving us the time.
Frank Abagnale Jr. is a former con man made famous by the film Catch Me If You Can. He now runs the financial fraud consulting firm Abagnale & Associates and was in Hawaii to speak at an AARP Hawaii event.
Hi there, I'm DJ Mr. Nick, host of Bridging the Gap, here to invite you to our first ever Hawaii Public Radio Halloween Party. It takes place on Friday, October 27th in HPR's Atherton Studio. I'll be mixing a funky Halloween-themed set live while we broadcast the party onto Facebook. Tickets are by donation and go to help support Hawaii Public Radio. Get yours by visiting hprtickets.org.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, looking at ways to transform Hawaii government through its IT sector. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and give us your comments at this number, 802-808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.